Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I remember three or four weeks ago, when I got my first email from Bill kind of saying, well, we'd love to have you come up and spend the day and spend the afternoon and talk to us and meet some of the kids and then give this talk. And at the end of this email, it says, you know, could you plan on 45 minutes with some time for Q&A? And my first reaction was outright panic. It's like, how do I fill 45 minutes with these smart, intelligent kids and keep them interested and entertained and hopefully paying attention? So I went from complete panic to then all of a sudden my head started to fill with all these things I wanted to say and themes I wanted to touch on. And I literally spent this 1 hour one day when I was working out, like, it just, like, the ideas wouldn't stop. And so I went from overload to overload. And I finally, you know, processed it enough where I managed to distill it down and threw up a few slides, which we're going to go through. And then I was talking to some friends, one of my advisors from my fund, and then just a friend, and saying, you know, I'm going to give this talk tomorrow for 45 minutes, and I'm a little nervous, and how am I going to keep their attention? And I said, I'm probably just going to end up putting up some slides and then just riffing. And they both said, just do that. That's what really gets people's attention, keeps them interested, and you connect with your audience. And so we're going to have a combination, a blend of some numbers and stats and points that I'm going to make off the slides, but mostly I'm just going to talk to you guys about stuff that I think is important and hopefully interesting. It all fits in this whole system, I keep calling it, of the startup world, of entrepreneurship, of why it's great to start a company, of why it's great to be your age and thinking about starting a company, if that's what you're thinking about doing, why it's great to be at UCSB and thinking about starting a company, or being a venture capitalist. I even got some stuff about that in here. I know you've heard, if you've been in prior lectures, you've heard from some venture capitalists over the past year or two. I am going to talk a little bit about venture capital itself, but I'm going to talk about some other themes that are important in this whole context. And then the other thing I'm going to do is talk a little bit about Southern California from a venture capital perspective, just to give you a sense of, you know, what is this environment we operate in here that relates to venture capital. So the broad agenda, just 2 seconds on me. I'm going to level set us as a group on what do I mean when I use that phrase? Because it has a lot of, it gets talked about a lot. What is a venture capitalist? What does venture capital mean? I'm just going to level set my definition so you guys know when I say that what I mean. I'm going to talk in a big picture way about the macro world of the startup, of starting a company from literally a global perspective, because I think it really impacts kind of what the opportunity is for you guys and some of the things that affect, you know, how do you think about starting a company and what's going on in the bigger picture. And it's just going to be some stuff to make you think, I hope. Do an overview of what Southern California is doing these days in terms of venture capital. Talk about being a venture capitalist, if you want to start a company, and then kind of close on a thematic point I want to make for all of you. So, and I'm just going to have to wander around because I got to move the slides along. So, briefly, as you saw, if you saw the poster, I've been doing startup investing as a professional venture capitalist since 1985. That's a really long time. That's why my hair is so gray. It's always been early stage and information technology. So essentially, I've been doing kind of hanging around this startup world for a long time. I've managed to stay in it for a long time. You can see the names of the firms. I took a few years off until last year. Then, as last year ended, 2010 ended, and 2011 started, I just decided to start my own firm. I've got a partner, a really super guy, used to work at Broadcom, made a lot of money, ran one of my companies that I was an investor in, and now we're working together. And you can see my undergrad from Cal, and then I got a business degree at SC's business school. And then I was lucky enough just to be in the right place at the right time and got into the business. Excuse me. So what is venture capital? So these are the factors that I consider when I say the word venture capital. And it distills down to professional. I get in my all of my work in this area, I've been paid to do it. I am, as my salary comes from it, I get rewarded if I do it successfully. It's not my money, mostly. And that's an important distinction when you think about angel investors, because by in the sort of generalized definition of angels, usually they are investing their own money because they have it, and they desire to make these small investments in startup companies. But they're not doing it to make a living. They've already made their money, and they're choosing to kind of make this investment process part of their lives because they enjoy it. Okay, I want to touch for a moment on information technology because that's the area I specialize in. And it's the area that venture capital kind of grew up around. I mean, some of the earliest investments in our industry were in companies like Intel back in the 60s around the development of transistors. So I've got a question for the audience. And maybe just, I know we're supposed to have mics, but you can just shout out your answer. Why do we do information technology? Why don't we do grocery stores or, you know, pet stores? Or why information technology? Why IT? Does anybody want to try to? Yeah.
Greater potential for growth.
That's exactly right. Why is there greater potential growth in information technology? Why can you grow a company faster in information technology? Anybody want to give that one a shot? No. Okay, the answer is the pace of innovation. You look at Moore's Law. You look at the cost of storage. You look at CPUs per dollar. The pace of innovation is accelerating. So if you can harness innovation in that space, then you can get that growth, and growth converts into value. So only in technology-driven industries can you start a company, innovate, create something hard, and grow very rapidly. And as I was saying to some of the kids today, growth creates value, growth rates. So if you can go from 0 to 20 to 50 million in revenues because you've leveraged some kind of technology, you'll get a very high multiple on your company, and you'll sell for 500 million bucks. Since I'm a venture capitalist and I'm giving you 500 grand and I'm taking a whole risk on just you, I need to see that payday, and that's why money was focused on those early guys at Intel who invented the first microprocessor, because people were realizing that this electronics thing was going to create huge growth. So that's why. Now, life science is a whole other area that I don't want to ignore, but I just don't know anything about it. It's parallel. I mean, obviously, rapid innovation, more regulated, but very important. Energy is still, for most people, still a bit of a wild card because, yes, there's innovation, but you're still essentially delivering it into a regulated market, which is a scary thing. Okay, startups. Venture capital means startups. Now, what is a startup? A startup is generally anything from 4 or 5 people in a room with a PowerPoint to maybe you've got a product and you've got some customers and you're doing maybe $1 million a year in revenues. Beyond that, it becomes growth capital. And to me, that's not a startup anymore. You're an existing business. So that's kind of the sweet spot for venture capital. It's total risk capital. Most of the time, we don't make money on our investments. You've had other VCs probably tell you the same thing. So it's risk. And as I was saying to some of the kids today, when I sit across the table from a person who wants my money, I'm looking at that person. That's all I've got. There's generally no revenues. There's generally only the beginnings of a product, and there's just potential. So we're just taking a big risk. We want to become a partner, but we are understanding the risks we're taking. The last thing is, most venture capitalists like to think what we want to do is be on the same level of the company with the investor, because really what we want to do is build the biggest company we can and build as much value to that stock. So we all want to be just focused on that stock. That's all we want to care about. We don't want to care about who has what job when, or some other factor, lifestyle, whatever. It's about building value. So when we invest, we want to feel like we are with the the entrepreneur, we're on the same page. We're all trying to do the same thing, which is build a valuable company. All right, so this is just kind of a perspective slide. It looks kind of, I wasn't really happy with the way it turned out, but I just want to have everybody kind of understand. We're going to kind of go into the global thing now. The bottom bar is the U.S. gross domestic product in 2010. All goods and services produced by U.S. domiciled companies, $14.8 trillion. That's a lot of money. So then you step down. Okay, what's another big number? The defense budget, $685 billion. Still pretty big. Drop down again. Apple market cap, $323 billion. Pretty big. That's a pretty big company. Apple's worth a lot of money. In the bubble, Cisco's market cap touched $500 billion. Hasn't been there since. The entire U.S. venture capital industry, so-called, has $177 billion under management. That means if you add up all the venture capitalists and all the money that's been committed to them, it's $177 billion. It's actually a lot smaller than it was three years ago. Not a lot smaller. And just, again, we're just kind of just being doing a big perspective look here. $2.5 billion last year in 2010 was invested in Southern California startups. So it's just a way of, we're a tiny piece. I'm going to come back to this later. We're a small piece of the economy if you look at it on a numerical basis. However, startups, venture-backed startups, all startups, have an enormous impact on the economy. And so don't forget that relative scale. Okay, partial big economic picture. People talk about the United States. They say, you know, we're on the decline. China's going to eat our lunch. India's going to eat our lunch. The European Union's going to really hammer us. We have issues with immigration and education and the deficit and stuff. Let's just remember some of the things still about the U.S. Told you about the GDP. Our GDP is still 25% of the entire planet. It's as big as the next three countries combined. So we're still pretty darn successful in churning out goods and services. The exchange capitalization, which is adding up the value of the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, together, is still more than a proportional share of the world value. So all the trading of the value of the companies, it's not just U.S. companies, other companies, it still takes place on New York, U.S.-based exchanges, slightly less than the next six exchanges in the world combined, including China, Hong Kong, Europe, FTSE in London, that sort of thing. So we're still, I'm not like a flag waver, I'm just pointing out, this is a gigantic economy. It still is pretty darn meaningful in the scope of our economic big picture. So again, coming back to our country's place in the world, what about other stuff? Okay, you know, are we safe? Do we have freedom? Do we take care of our people with health and stuff like that? There's an entity that thinks about these exact things. They put together this thing called the Prosperity Index. And we are number 10. Anybody want to take a shot at number one? This is on the Prosperity Index defined by this private institute. They measure all these factors, economic, social, health, kind of the soft side of being a country. And there's a I'm just going to, you know, throw it out there. Who do you think the number one country in the world is? It's not by economic size. No. Who said Norway? Norway. Several of the Scandinavian countries are in the top 10 because they really take care of their citizens. Now, their economies are not that big. So, we obviously have our issues. Number one, in my opinion, financial responsibility. Number two, our immigration policy is all screwed up. And number three, we obviously, you guys are counterexamples. We have a really kind of spotty educational system. So we're not all about economics, but we're still pretty far up there. So, okay, we're number 10. And I forget, actually, give me 1 second. I brought it because I thought it would be interesting. I'm not going to make you listen to this for too long. Okay. Norway number one. four other Scandinavian countries in the top 10. The next three countries in terms of GDP that we talked about before are Germany, Japan, and China. Germany is number 15. Japan is number 19. Anybody want to take a stab at China? Anybody? 58. If you look at things like, you know, general health care, political safety, political freedom, they get dinged on a lot of factors. So I'm not saying we shouldn't think about these factors as a country, but we are still a darn good place to do a lot of stuff. And you, all of you, your generation, I hope, are going to help us do something about those other things. Here's a scary big picture. The disc came out like a week ago. Somebody wrote that article. That was their title. That's purchasing power parity. It's an economic term. I'm not sure exactly what it means. Something about if you equate all, if you take out exchange rates and, you know, what you can buy for a dollar in China and what you can buy in a dollar for other countries, what you can buy for a dollar in the U.S., cost of living stuff, we're going to get our butts kicked in 2016. And we're not going to be on top anymore. So we clearly are challenged in our sort of position in the world. So I want you to just remember that we've got our kind of good times and we're doing okay, but there's some threats. On the other hand, you know, if you take every curve that was ever drawn and draw it just continuing, you know, it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, 30 years ago, Japan had us convinced that we were going to have our entire semiconductor industry taken over. Didn't happen. 25 years ago, everybody had us convinced that our cars sucked and Japan and then Korea and other countries were going to eat our lunch. And that's still happening, but obviously, given some of the recent news with companies like Toyota, it's just, you just can't always say curves are going to go in the same direction forever. Okay, so what does this all mean? Why am I doing all this? In my opinion, if anyone in the world is thinking about starting a company, this is still the place to do it. Why is that? Okay, by definition, if you sit in this country and you start to do something, you have immediately available to you some of the biggest markets in the world. That's also true of China, but China has some other things it doesn't have. Also true of India, has some things we don't have. We have some things they don't have. Appetite for risk. The culture of, I believe, the culture of, the culture here is one of risk taking. Take a chance. Go for it. Just do it. You see it every day in our media. We believe that's who we are. And I believe that's who we are. That's why it is not a badge of, it's not a kiss of death to fail. It is a badge of honor because you gave it a shot. So I think in this country, in my opinion, we hold risk as a part of our culture that I think is really important. Political risk. We don't have a perfect government. No country has a perfect government. I think in our country and some of the European countries and some of the Scandinavian countries, we have lower risk of someone coming in and taking away what you've earned than most places in the world. And that's an important thing. You get to keep what you do. Talent. We have talent. We are creative. We want to try new stuff. We want to do new stuff. That's essential. And that is why it's so fun to do what I do. Because I get to just write checks, sort of. But I get to work with people that are incredibly driven, smart, and talented and creative. And to me, that's really gives me a charge. You get to keep it all. It's all meritocracy. We don't care anything about who you are or where you're from. If you can prove that, you know, you're deserving of the merits of starting a company or whatever you do, you get those. It doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. Of course, there's, you know, discrepancies and it's not perfect, but I would argue that in this country, it's more true than anywhere else. We are capitalists. We just are. It's our system. And it works. And it's a free market capital system. Obviously, it gets impacted and pushed around, and you know, governments bail out auto companies, and we fight about that stuff, but we still basically are a capitalist system. That's kind of how we've grown up, and we've let it be that way for 250 years and kind of figured it out. And the infrastructure and kind of what is around the startup world to let it be easy to start a company, again, I feel is, I mean, certainly you could walk into Hong Kong and probably be up and running the next day. And on that Legatum Institute stuff, Norway's great on the entrepreneurship scale, so it's obviously easy in other countries. So, but we have it also. We have the financing structure, we have the capital markets, we have the ability to organize a company legally. For $300 on LegalZoom, you can create an LLC, a week later have a binder with certificates, be registered, and as long as you pay your taxes and don't break the law, no one's going to bother you. You can do whatever you want. That's a real important thing. Plus, there's this whole financing thing. Plus, there's all these other service providers, lawyers, accountants, search firms, that all want to support that system. The technology management program at UC Santa Barbara is here because it can be infrastructure for this system. This is the statistic I started to refer to later, which I'm sure you've read by now. This is from the National Venture Capital Association. Maybe some of you have seen this, but they went out and they added up the contribution to the gross domestic product of all companies that receive venture capital, which is not a gigantic number relative to all the companies in the country, 20% of our gross domestic product. That's, whatever, $3 trillion of goods and services. That's a lot. So there's an outsized impact from venture-backed startups, but not only that, from startups. This is the rejuvenation that has to take place that is part of our DNA that makes, I believe, being here in the U.S. and starting a company, this is the best place to do it. Okay, so now we're going to take a little bit of a branch. We're going to go off and just talk a little bit about what's going on in venture capital in Southern California, just to give you a sense of kind of the landscape around here. This is going to be more back into kind of down from that other planet I was on for a minute and now coming back down and to ground a little bit. Okay. This graph reflects the national graph, which is we were a little cottage industry until the late 90s. Then the internet happened. I remember in 1997, I was at a conference in LA. It was called Digital Hollywood. And it was all about the internet and how it related to the entertainment industry. And no one really knew what the internet was going to be except that it was super smoking hot and a lot of people were trying to figure out what to do with it. And the movie companies, of course, said, well, we got to take advantage of this technology. We got to figure out how to deliver our movies over the internet. And, that was before the music industry got eaten by the internet. Anyway, I'm in this audience listening to a panel discussion, and on the panel is a very senior Hollywood studio executive. And they're starting to talk about the internet and how it's going to impact entertainment. And he looked at the audience and he says, and he's an old line Hollywood guy, he says, I wake up every morning and I wish the internet would go away. And to me, it's like it was such a game-changing thing that happened, not only obviously to entertainment, but to our entire business infrastructure. And so what happened was, obviously, it just attracted this deluge of capital. Deluge, I mean, flood. So we went from, you know, this $2 billion a year business to $13 billion. The industry as a whole went from like $15 billion to $100 billion overnight, two years. That's when, you know, companies were going public, search was the rage. It was an amazing, weird time. So then obviously the bubble burst, and the way I like to talk about it is there was this huge party in 2000. Everybody got really plastered. We have spent, venture capitalists and a lot of technology companies, spent the next 10 years with a massive hangover. Because the impact of that amount of money was it killed our returns for 10 years. because so much money could not possibly force itself through the startup system and come out the other end with good returns. And so needless to say, it dropped. It's kind of steady stated it nationally at about $15-20 billion, but we are still working off kind of the excesses of 2000. Only now do I believe that we're finally getting over it. We've had some, partial recoveries. That 2008 crash made a big difference in making sure we were not fully recovered. Okay, so there have been some actual, things have started to happen. I updated this just yesterday. This is Southern California. So you can see in the bubble, I've got some of the names. There were a lot of really successful companies that went public, got on the map in the bubble and were successful Southern California exits. Broadcom was founded in 1995, went public in 1998, Stamps.com. I forget all the names. But they're going to be on a subsequent slide. But then the bubble happened. You can see for 9 years, almost nothing happened. Very quiet relative to the bubble. And the bubble was a bunch of artificial exits. They were purely frothy driven. They were not real. And a lot of people made a lot of money, but we paid the price. We started to get a little better in the middle of the decade, and then the 2008 crash happened and crashed again. But in 2010, we had a bunch of IPOs here in Southern California. Well, I'll talk about them in a sec. 2011 is off to a very strong start, so things are improving. But there's some deceiving, it's a little deceiving, because it's only the really good companies that have hung on this long that are coming out, and there's still a whole bunch of, for lack of a better word, dreck in the venture capital portfolios that is still being gradually purged out. So as an industry, we're still kind of cleaning house and getting our house in order. Okay, so this is about a little more granularity. I put the names up here. Maybe just jumping to the... So you can see some of the names of the successful companies from 10 years ago and some of the more recent successes. The interesting thing is 7 IPOs from Southern California companies. These are completed IPOs, not registrations. In 2010 and 2011, there are a few others that are in registration right now. So overall, very, very encouraging. The interesting thing is, on that prior slide, there was a big spike. So that represents $6 billion of exit value in 2011 for Southern California VC-backed. Oh, by the way, I include self-financed. So these are all IT startups that are tracked by these databases that I look at. However, the number of companies that exited to create that $63 billion indicates an average exit value of $9 million, meaning we are still flushing out all these companies at little or no value. We have some headliners, but there's still a lot of stuff that's kind of churning out of the VC portfolios that we have yet to kind of clean house of. But nonetheless, encouraging. And this is obviously happening in the Bay Area in spades. If you read about the Bay Area, the venture capital and startup community up, or startup environment up there is just insane. It's a scary place, and I worry they're getting a little ahead of themselves. But I like Southern California. It's more a little more sane down here. Okay, maybe this is a little out of order, but this is what continues to drive us. Information technology, information demand, devices. It's unbelievable, these devices. iPad 2 and Google Zoom, it's just amazing where this innovation is taking us. Now, granted, it's not necessarily new kinds of semiconductor chips, and those are being innovated by the really big companies. But still, innovation is happening at an amazing pace, and the hunger for delivering information is still exploding. And this left hand, I've stolen this chart with permission from another company, but the left hand is the demand for bandwidth. And so, as you guys all know, if you have an iPad You can watch Netflix. You can listen, you know, watch full motion video, live streaming video on your on a device as big as a piece of paper, which would be unheard of, you know, 10 years ago. And that is not going to ever stop. There's always more demand, and that's kind of what keeps driving this whole engine. Somehow, all these companies I invested in ended up on this slide. I don't know how that happened. Okay, so now we're going to go kind of off into sort of what if you want to do this? I guess the first thing I should say about being a venture capitalist is our business is getting smaller. We are in a consolidation mode. It was hard to get jobs before. Now it's almost impossible because there were too many of us. And we are getting downsized as an industry, as we should. So that's the bottom bullet. Things that are helpful, none of these are bulletproof requirements if you think you would like to do this. First of all, I'll preface it by saying there's two paths, which I have up there. One is the academic path, which is the classic path, is undergrad engineering, work, master's in business, entry level at a venture firm. Still tried and true. Our business loves some sort of ability to understand technology, and then you add on the kind of the business understanding, and then you go apprentice, you know, at a VC firm and hopefully enjoy it and do well and become a partner. The other way, which is can be blended with the first way, is to work for several years in technology, maybe build and sell a company a couple times, understand the dynamics of an industry, and that's also a path. Part of the thing that makes the business hard to get into is it's, you know, we're mostly pretty small groups of say five or six or less. It's rare that there's only some very large firms like Kleiner and Oak and NEA and that have, say, 10 or 15 professionals. But even in those firms, personal chemistry and just getting along, it's just such a collegial, consensus-driven kind of business that that personal kind of level of interaction is important. I've never obviously been in a law firm or an accounting firm. They're smaller, but there it's more, you know, each lawyer owns his clients, and, you know, maybe there's less. But in our business, we have to decide when to invest, and it's got to be... And there's benefits to collaboration, so that part is probably at least as important as any of the other parts. So those would be the things I think about if you have in this head, maybe in your head. And by the way, I'm happy to take questions, you know, about this whole thing in the Q&A. So if you have this in your head, as maybe I would like to do this someday, there's a lot of ways to get to it. Go work first, do something else, you know, get some experience, maybe go back to graduate school, and then see where you are when that happens. When I got into graduate school, I didn't even know what venture capital was. I just kind of stumbled on it and got lucky and got in it. Okay, this is the part I really think is fun and I really want to be passionate about. Because this is what I enjoy just having a chance to associate with. I am assuming that most of you wouldn't sit in this room unless you had some inclination or thought, or I don't know, you hang out with your friends and they're talking about starting their own company, so you're here because you've thought, you're associated with it in some way. Just do it. Just take the leap. I mean, I honestly mean that. I've got a 21-year-old son, Georgetown. He's going to get a liberal arts degree. He doesn't know what he wants to do. I said, take a risk. You know, just go. You're 21, you're 22, you're 23, whatever. You will have no better time in your entire life to try something new. So I am looking at a bunch of very smart, talented people who wouldn't be in this room if they didn't go here, and they wouldn't go here if you weren't really smart. So give it a shot. And I just want to encourage you to go off the edge. It's a seller's market, believe it or not. There is a lot, in spite of all that stuff about the industry shrinking, there is a lot of individual money. There's a lot in this town. There's a lot in Southern California. There's a whole bunch in the Bay Area, but also it's ultra competitive to get it. So I would argue that capital is relatively abundant because everybody's falling in love again with kind of the startup world. And I think there's going to be a reconciliation with some of it in a little bit, in 2 or 3 years. But, I mean, the money's there. So us professional VCs, we like to say we have deep pockets but short arms. We have money, but we are incredibly discriminating, and we're really nasty, nasty people on how much of your company we will want for the money we will invest. And we're predatory, and we're other words that I used in smaller groups. So on the other hand, we like to think, first of all, we are there with you. We don't write a $100,000 check and then disappear. We like to think we're there to build the whole company with you and for a continuous source of financing. So that's something we think is a positive. We like to think we bring a whole bunch of experience of having seen it, been there, done that, pattern recognition, contacts, the whole thing. So there's obviously advantages. The one thing I would say, if you decide to go the professional VC route, if you start a company and you have that opportunity, is decide. Don't decide based on pricing or anything like that. Decide, I'm going to raise money from venture capitalists because I think it's a good way to finance my company. And then just get whatever the market will bear, because I guarantee you won't like the price, but it's going to be the lowest. It's going to be the highest possible price for your, you will suffer the most for your equity compared to some other sources. But we think we have an advantage. So if an entrepreneur is talking to me and he's got like maybe a corporate investor or a couple of angels or a professional VC, I say you have to sort of decide you're going to take money from these VCs and then just go with it. Because if you start comparing us to the other alternatives, we're going to look really bad. And maybe you should just go to those other alternatives. Because we do feel like over time, we bring benefits. And as that statistic proved earlier, we do help create value. But we're a mixed bag. But we really feel like we're good at what we do. There's a whole bunch of what I would call angel money. And that is really great money for starting your company. And, you know, subject to lots of things and how you get along and the valuation and how much money do you need and when, and really thinking hard about how do you raise money for your company, angels are a great, great way to start. Just know, in my opinion, that you have to make sure you plan for after your angels, because it's rare that if you have to raise 10 or 15 million or more, that an angel group will stay with you all the way through that 10 or 15 million. So that's just one thing you have to think about. Okay, so in this culture, as I mentioned earlier, there is no penalty for risk taking or losing, I should say. So don't worry about that. I told my son, sorry to be able to put the family in here, but you know, do it now, try it. No one's gonna fault you for giving something a shot. So again, I'm trying to encourage you, inspire you to just do it if you want to. This is really important. Know yourself. Know who you are. Know what you can do. Know what you can't do. Be realistic. Be grounded. find partners that bring to the table things you don't have, vice versa. So you kind of have a sense, be self-aware, I think is really important. Ask for advice. That's sort of a no-brainer, but I thought I'd put it up there anyway. Look around the table, look around your school, look around your faculty. You've got a lot of places you can go talk to people and get good advice. A place like here, you go talk to Bill Grant, you say, Bill, I got this idea, should I enter it in the venture competition? And you know, or you know a professor, and it's a technology, you want to maybe research. There's lots of resources. That's to validate your plan, and then obviously get some people around you who can be guides. You've got a whole mentoring program here, which is very useful and helpful, and you can take full advantage of. Okay, end of presentation. One quote you have to take a minute to read. The other one you don't. Both kind of more or less say the same thing. Does anybody recognize either of those quotes? And if you do recognize either one, I want you to raise your hand.
Is the top one from Dante's Inferno?
Nope. Not even close. Come on, the second one's for much more of a, well, he's more my contemporary than your guys' contemporary, but. Okay, let's see, I'll give you a hint. The second one is from a major sports celebrity, or past. Right, Michael Jordan. The guy who was cut from his basketball team in high school. He went on to do okay. Okay, the second language, language is a little more florid and dated, and but you know, it really kind of says the same thing. And does anybody have want to take a shot? If not, I'll give you guys a hint. Yeah. Bingo! That's exactly right. And this guy was an amazing guy if you ever read about him. But he would just, he did everything. I mean, he's got some great biographies out. So he is truly, it's an inspiring quote. And so I put those two things up there in closing because I want you guys as young, talented, smart, driven, directional people who sit in a room like this and listen to this old guy talk to you about all this stuff. If you're thinking about doing something with a company, just give it a shot. That is what is core to our system here in this country. It's core to who we are. Okay, so now last piece of show and tell. This is a little book. It has a document in it. It's an important document. It's reproduced. The document is 4,500 words. 4,500 words. That's probably what, a 10-page paper maybe? Less? 7-page paper? If you had to write a paper, double-spaced? I don't know. I can't remember. I haven't written a paper for a long time. So 4,500 words. It's a really, really important document. Essentially, it's the business plan for something. Anybody want to take a shot? Yes, you in the back. You got it. The Constitution. This was a business plan. No, this wasn't a business plan. This was a political plan for a country and a government. The 4,500 words includes all the amendments after. The original one is really short and very vague, but it was because a bunch of guys got in a room for 4 months in Philadelphia in the summer and said, what we got now isn't working. We need to fix it. And then they left it to everybody else afterwards to figure it out. And is the shortest and longest lasting government document of this type in the world. So I show it to you because it truly was, it was an innovation. No one had done this before, ever. It was all about aristocracy and heredity and who married whom and who won a war over whom. No one had ever created a government out of a blank sheet of paper. We had an opportunity. These guys decided, let's give this a shot because we can. And so we were, in a way, to really stretch the analogy, we were a startup as a country. And we have had many flaws, many faults, many things we didn't do very well. Don't have to go into all of them, but we have survived and flourished and thrived as a system because we innovated. And I think that kind of permeates down into our entire culture, to how we think about the world, how we try to strive to be better. And it's all because a bunch of white European guys sat in a room and said, we've got to figure out something new, and we're going to invent something. And they did, and it lasted. So you guys can all do the same thing in the business world or in your lives, and I just encourage you to do it. Thank you very much.
Is it more common for venture capitalists to take the academic route or be entrepreneurs and take the professional route before becoming a VC?
More fun? Is that it? More common? I think in today's world, it's probably equal. It used to be more traditional, the academic route, more common. But actually, the venture capital industry got started out of people who grew up in the semiconductor industry and then left and started backing other semiconductor startups. I mean, again, there's no hard and fast way, but operating experience is very valuable. I mean, I know there's a new fund, in the Bay Area, and I met him. He's a young guy. He had formed a fund after selling a couple of startups to Google, so he kind of knew the entrepreneurial world, very thoughtful, though, and so he formed a fund and he raised money from investors. So he took that route. I'm the more old school traditional route. So I guess I don't have a hard and fast answer.
Who were some of the mentors in your career, and why would they stand out in particular for you?
So I think of one guy who was about 15 years older than I am. He was a really successful businessman, ran and grew a couple of companies, sold them out, and I didn't necessarily go to him and ask him advice, but he was always a guy I could talk to about what I was, you know, thinking about. And so he was if I had to categorize him, he was a guy who ran a big company, but also was a successful investor, great people skills. I just kind of respected all the qualities that he had.
How much influence would an MBA have over, I guess, like a venture capitalist?
You mean getting one?
Yeah, getting one.
It has value. I mean, most of the people in our world have, not everybody, but most people have graduate degrees of some sort. But I would encourage you, if you're thinking about it, to go work for a while, be out in the world, make some money, make some mistakes. It'll make your MBA that much more valuable when you come back. So, but it helps. It helps. Definitely helps. Especially if you have, when you say soft, meaning liberal arts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it my son has a liberal, he's going to have a liberal arts today, a degree, and he says, "Dad, I got no skills." I said, "Well, don't worry about it." But anyway, think, okay, I'm going to go work, I'll do something, I'll get out there, and, then I'll then go back for that graduate degree.
What was, like, the first, like, risky, I guess, move that you made in your career?
I'm thinking about a couple of possible answers. Gosh. You know what? I'm going to kind of take it, and I'm going to answer the question in a way you're not expecting. I got a job out of graduate school. I got a job out of college. I got a job out of graduate school. So I never, like, leaped off as I'm telling you to do. But I did leap off 8-9 months ago when I decided to start my own thing. And so I think I'm taking the biggest risk I could take right now. Because if I were to follow some people's advice, they would say, you know, change career paths. Go do something else. Your industry is shrinking. There's no jobs. I like what I do. So I said, okay, well, I'm pretty good at it. I know how to do it. I'll figure it out. So I'm not going to go do that, even though it's financially painful. And so I'm taking a risk. My wife is sort of tolerating me. But that is probably the biggest risk I've taken, which sounds kind of odd to answer, but, you know, it took me till I was now to do it. And I'm encouraging you not to wait as long as I did.
Could you identify maybe other parts of the country outside of California that you see as hotspots for investment, not just in IT sector, but others as well?
Sure. So the question is other areas of the country. Seattle, Portland to a lesser extent, Austin, Denver, Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City, smoking. Most of it's around technology, because there's just something that grows up around a technology community that's entrepreneur.
What's unique about those locations?
Highly educated workforces, past success of technology companies. I mean, each of those places have, or existing large technology companies. Boston has always been, I mean, really, that's where we got started as an industry. Those are the ones. Really, a highly educated workforce, talented engineers, abundant labor pool, a culture ecosystem like I was describing earlier. Those all exist in all those places. San Diego, it's not really out of California.
How much influence does a venture capitalist have over, like, how the company is run initially in the beginning and stuff? Like, how much of a say does the entrepreneur actually listen to what you say?
So influence, we have some, but I don't want to have too much if I were that venture capitalist. When I do what I do, which is to make an investment, I do not want to have too much influence because I am not, I'm a source of some good influence and advice and guidance, but personally, I don't give money to somebody else so I can influence it. I give money to other people so they can do something with it. So there's limited influence, and I, you know, there's strategy and advice. How part of your question was, how do I get them to listen, or how do we get them to listen? Well, we try to test that out up front because we do feel like there's some need for what we call coachability, especially if you're young. If you think you know everything, and this is a, you know, a generic you, if you think you know everything and you don't want to listen to anybody else, that's a bad sign. And not only do I want you to hear what I have to say, which I think might be constructive, but you're going to have to work with other people who are probably also going to be giving you advice. So plus, the last piece is there's a personal relationship. You have to work with these with someone who you're investing in, and you have to have a sort of a way to work through things. And so you have to be able to listen to each other. So all of that's very important. There has to be a certain level of like, if you will. So all that needs to play into it. I mean, it's a business partnership in many ways. On the other hand, the venture capitalist has to listen to the management because they essentially are trying to, they're on the ground. They are deciding every day, how do we do this? And if management comes to me and I trust and respect them and they say, you know, we really got to do this, chances are, unless I just have some reason that I think it's an awful idea, I'll say, okay, if you think so, then let's do it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.